Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Does Utah need a new court to hear constitutional cases? The House GOP is moving quickly to make it happen. Utah is set to buy one of the state's major polluters in a $30 million commitment to the Great Salt Lake. And is President Russell Nelson's push to drop the Mormon name working with Latter-day Saints and outsiders? Will it last? Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here, Tom.
Good to have you with us. Water and land use reporter Leah Larson's with us. Leah, thank you.
Hey there. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Good to have you with us. And later in the program, we'll be talking with senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Let's start with Robert Gerke. This was a surprise to me. I don't know about to you. This is moving quickly. The idea to have a constitutional court, what would this be?
Yeah, so the way Representative McPherson, Matt McPherson of West Valley, presented this in committee the other day, he envisions it as having three judges who have statewide jurisdiction, and their job is to hear constitutional challenges to laws passed by the legislature. And so if there's a case where, say, you know, the Better Boundaries dispute that's been going on for a while now, if somebody's challenging a law that the legislature passes, rather than going through a regular district court judge, as it would now, it would go before one of these three designated constitutional court judges. And so the thinking is that they would have expertise in the Constitution, although, you know, arguably everybody learns about the Constitution in law school. So that's sort of the counter argument, I guess. But they would take these cases and they would handle them expeditiously. And he thinks that this would get these disputes resolved more quickly. He got pushback on this, obviously, the state office of the courts and the Utah State Bar both opposed this, as did a number of attorneys who spoke in the committee, because they said, essentially, what this would allow the legislature to do is pick the three judges that they want to hear the constitutional challenges to the laws that they pass, and know that that those would be the three judges who would hear these cases at the district, at the lower court level. Now, all the rulings that these constitutional court judges would issue would still be reviewable by the Utah Supreme Court. The Utah Supreme Court still gets the last word, but from Representative McPherson's standpoint, he wants to have, he thinks that these judges would have more expertise in constitutional law and be able to process these cases more quickly.
Now, some, I think, are suspicious. Legislators just want maybe a more favorable panel. What's the sponsor? What are Republicans saying to that?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I mean, obviously, we've talked before on the show about all of the cases that have gone before the courts and been blocked by judges. For example, Utah's trigger law that bans abortion. We've talked about redistricting a lot here. Obviously, they keep losing in court there. Their law that banned transgender girls from playing high school sports got blocked by the courts until the case got dismissed. And so there are all these instances where the legislature has lost in district court. The critics of this say, well, they're just trying to change the referees in the game, basically. They want to be able to pick the referees so they have a favorable panel. Now, Representative McPherson says that, no, the judges that would be on this constitutional court would still be chosen the same way, you know, chosen by the governor, nominated by the governor, and confirmed by the Senate. But, you know, like I said, the state office of the courts and the state bar both said, well, you know, this looks like you guys are trying to it would undermine public trust in the independence of the judiciary. They said if the legislature is picking the judges that they know are going to hear challenges to the laws that they pass. There's a little bit of a standoff here. It's as I mentioned, it passed the House Law Enforcement Committee. Will be up for a vote potentially today in the House, and then going over to the Senate. There's some talk about sort of changing the way it's structured a little bit. I talked to Senate Majority Leader Kirk Cullimore yesterday, who is a supporter of the concept, and the way he envisions it. It wouldn't be designated. These judges wouldn't only handle constitutional cases, but they would be designated as the judges who would be who would get these cases should they arise. And so that's a little bit of a different twist on it, but it still creates this whole pathway for these laws to take. And with only three judges and statewide jurisdiction, you could certainly envision a scenario where the legislature would want the judges who are most favorable to their interpretation of the Constitution and interpretation of the law holding those positions. So this is one that's created a little bit of controversy, as well as there's a proposal that we've talked about here from Senator Chris Wilson up in your neck of the woods, who wants to expand the Utah Supreme Court, add two justices there. And that's already drawn, claims, accusations that they're trying to pack the court and get more favorable justices on the state court because they're tired of losing there. And so, the two of these taken together, particularly when we're talking about challenges to laws that the legislature passes, it could dramatically change the way that those cases, those challenges, end up being heard by the courts.
This could also go to the question of resources as well, right? There, some Republicans say that they're putting two new justices on the Supreme Court to unblock the backlog. The courts are saying, well, the backlog is not in the Supreme Court; it's lower. So, I guess these three judges could help if they were district judges.
Yeah, so that's sort of how both of these bills are being framed in some ways. The expansion of the Utah Supreme Court, the Chief Justice said on the first day of the legislative session when he gave his State of the Judiciary speech, he said the courts have essentially no backlog. He said that they are able to handle all of the cases that come before them, and actually adding justices would probably slow the process down, or potentially slow the process down, because then you've got to deal with, getting input and editing opinions and making sure you have four people to sign off on it instead of three. So he thinks it could actually delay cases before the Utah Supreme Court. But also, the larger issue, as you've noted, is not that they think that there's a backlog at the court. They think there's backlogs further on down. When you're talking about criminal appeals, the Indigent Defense Commission, they think is underfunded. They've been asking the legislature for several years now for additional judges at the district court level and at the appellate court level. This year they've been asking for seven judges at the district court level, a juvenile court judge, and an appellate court judge, because they said that there's their caseloads. I mean, some of these judges, according to their most recent report, are handling 130% of what their optimal caseload is, and so they're overworked, and that creates delays in getting these cases through, particularly on the civil side, frankly, because criminal cases are prioritized because people have a constitutional right to a criminal trial. So those cases get prioritized, and the civil cases end up languishing at the district court level, at the appellate court level, and so they don't. It takes a long time for these cases to make it to the Supreme Court. So they're saying that that's not where the resources are needed. They're needed further on down the pipeline.
What is the legislature planning on? Are they adding district judges, appellate judges?
Yeah, so as part of the Supreme Court expansion bill, it adds two justices to the Supreme Court, two appellate court judges, and then they've added, right now at least, tentatively, as the bill had passed the Senate, they've added a judge at the third, fourth, and fifth district, which is Salt Lake, Utah County, and Washington County. So those are the three that they're targeting. Again, well short of the eight that the courts say they need. And then, Representative McPherson's bill with the Constitutional Court, as it's currently structured, again, Senator Cullimore told me yesterday that that could change, would add three additional judges that then would be backfilled. If they come off the court, say a judge decides they want to be a constitutional court judge, they would hire a judge to replace them. That's how the bill's structured now. So potentially six, and that carries about a $9.5 million price tag. As I said, they may change the way that's structured, so the three judges on the Constitutional Court are not new judges or additional judges. But the short answer to your question, sorry, I got carried away there. But the short answer to your question is, right now, as Senator Wilson's bill is structured, it would have three additional district court judges in Salt Lake, Utah, and Washington counties.
No, it's good clarification. These new constitutional judges would not be new judges, I guess. I guess one more thing from your story, Robert, of note, and you do note it in the story, the sponsor of this bill to add a constitutional court, Representative McPherson, he was not happy about Judge Gibson's ruling on the Better Boundaries case.
Right. Matt McPherson, we talked about before, was one of the legislators who said that Judge Diana Gibson should be impeached for the ruling she issued in the redistricting case. So he's a vocal critic of the courts, and you know, that kind of leads some to question his motivation in sort of proposing this new constitutional court. Again, this seems to have pretty broad support among some key senators. And so we'll watch that one play out potentially today in the House and then next week in the Senate.
Robert Gerke is with us, politics reporter with the Tribune. Let's move to another story. There's a poll out. Here's the headline. Most Utah voters oppose GOP lawmakers' effort to end anti-gerrymandering initiative. I guess, first of all, Robert, where is it? They have a February 14th deadline, I think, to get that initiative the enough signatures?
Yeah, actually, the deadline is February 15th. I may have
15th,
put the wrong.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, they've got until February 15th. They've got to get 140,748 valid signatures from voters across the state. As of yesterday, they were sitting at about 64,000-65,000. So they've got a ways to go. But I wouldn't read too much into that, because strategically it makes sense for them to hold back signatures and not submit them until they have to. So they could have a lot more signatures in their back pocket that they haven't turned in yet. So we don't know yet, I guess, is the short answer on whether that is headed for the ballot or not.
So this poll, I guess the bottom line of this poll is, even if they get the signatures and it is certified for the ballot in this year, it may not pass.
Yeah, and we should note at the outset that this was a poll that was commissioned by Better Boundaries, the supporters of the Proposition 4. And so, you know, you listeners can interpret that as they will, but basically the poll that they conducted said that the two-thirds of voters, I want to make sure I get the numbers right, two-thirds of voters are not supportive of repealing Prop 4. And 57% oppose the attempt to repeal the measure. Two-thirds support the Independent Redistricting Commission and ban on gerrymandering. So it's, that... Again, you put it before voters, that means even if it does get on the ballot, as you know, it could have a tough time passing. So, you know, we'll have to watch and see how this plays out.
And President Trump has weighed in, I believe, on this.
Yeah, last week, last Friday, he posted on social media encouraging Republicans and his supporters to get out and make sure that they sign the petitions. Senator Mike Lee this week sent out a video encouraging supporters to get out and sign the petitions. They've really kind of amped up the push to, you know, down the stretch here with about 2 weeks left to really make sure that they can try to get the signatures they need. And we'll have to kind of wait and see where they end up.
Well, thanks for telling us about these stories. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Tom.
I know we need to let you go, so we appreciate you coming on.
Yep, got to get back to work. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
You too. So following a break, we'll be bringing in Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Here's the headline. Utah is set to buy one of the state's major polluters in a $30 million commitment to the Great Salt Lake. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Hope you'll stay with us through the break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in next water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
Yeah, happy to be here again.
Good to have you with us. So this is a surprise to me. I don't know about to you. Utah is set to buy one of the state's major polluters in a $30 million commitment to the Great Salt Lake. So what are we talking about?
Yeah, I think this is a surprise to everybody except maybe the state of U.S. Magnesium. So, yeah, your listeners probably know that U.S. Magnesium a hugely polluting plant out by the western shore of the Great Salt Lake in Tooele County. It's one of the top polluters in the country. In fact, I think back when it operated as Magcor in like the 90s and the aughts, it was like the biggest air polluter in the country. So they've had all kinds of problems, all kinds of clashes with state environmental regulators and federal environmental regulators. They have a long, long sordid history of financial woes and bankruptcy courts and restructurings. And so basically, after going through the bankruptcy process almost 20 years ago, they restructured, became US Magnesium instead of Magcor, but still owned by the same company called Renco. They reached this agreement with the EPA that took almost 2 decades to forge, about how they were going to clean up their mess on the shores of the Great Salt Lake and protect the lake from having all their acidic wastewater from leaking in there. So everything was signed, good to go. And US Magnesium almost immediately began defaulting on its environmental obligations. And not only that, it started defaulting on its debts to contractors, to banks, to the state. The state claims it owes a bunch of royalties. So they were just in really hot water. And they had filed for bankruptcy to kind of prevent some lawsuits the state had filed against this company to force their hand and get them to start cleaning up their mess. So they filed for bankruptcy in September, which put all those lawsuits on pause, all those debt collections on pause, all those environmental cleanups on pause. And so we were all kind of waiting and wondering what was going to happen next. And sure enough, US Magnesium, its parent company Renco, which is based in New York, they put together yet another subsidiary company called LIMAG that appeared set to repeat what they did in the aughts and buy up all the assets, discharge the debt, and continue business as usual. But to our surprise, the state stepped in an auction a week ago and was the prevailing bidder. And so now the state of Utah, and I guess all of our residents here, own a small little tiny piece of that hugely polluting plant. And yeah, $30 million price tag, like you mentioned.
So what does the state get for this? They get land and I guess the machinery, everything that I guess water rights as well.
Yeah, so it's, all I have to go off of course, are the documents on the docket. And the state's bid has been a little bit contested by Wells Fargo, which was the biggest lender to US Magnesium. And they're not totally thrilled with the sale and the state being the prevailing bidder. Because what happened was US Magnesium filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which I'm no bankruptcy lawyer, but from my understanding, it's generally Chapter 11 bankruptcies. The intention there is to restructure the business. And then keep it operational so it's still making money and it can still pay down some of those debts as it goes. Whereas, like, Chapter 7 is a total liquidation where everything's just sold up and the business goes belly up, basically. So, when the state intervened and bought it, they did it with the intention of buying up its leases with the states to operate on the state lake bed and siphon water from the Great Salt Lake, buying up those leases, also buying up the water rights, and just putting the business to bed permanently. Let's just totally shutting it down, which Wells Fargo's arguing sounds more like a liquidation Chapter 7 than an actual Chapter 11. So there's some dispute there. All that is to say, that meandering response is to answer your question, what is the state getting out of the sale? It's not entirely clear, and it seems like the state, based on the court filings, is still negotiating with Wells Fargo and maybe even Tooele County, where they're owed millions in property taxes. But yes, it seems like they're at least going to get the real estate, which is like thousands of acres out there in Tooele County on Lake Shore. They're going to get the mineral lease, which the state issued in the first place, so the state's going to get that back. Looks like the water rights were included. And as far as equipment and machinery, it looks like Wells Fargo wants to at least get some of that for itself to sell off and pay down some of its own money owed by US Magnesium. So we'll see as far as like machinery and equipment goes, but it does look like the state secured water rights, land, and some other assets. You would hope they got something with the $30 million investment.
You would hope so, yes. So those water rights would be key, right? Is that going to be donated, quote unquote, to the Great Salt Lake?
I don't know. I mean, this is also developing and very much in motion. Fox 13 reported that they're donating the water to the Great Salt Lake, which would make a lot of sense. And it's no small quantity of water. Like, if you've ever seen the evaporation ponds out there, they pump a ton of water every year. So this is no small potatoes. But when I try to get the state to confirm, like, okay, so are you actually in fact gonna, I guess it wouldn't even be donating the water to the lake. It would just be leaving the water in the lake, which I suppose is a donation of its own. But yeah, the state has not confirmed that yet, but we'll see.
Now, I guess you break it, you own it. In this case, they didn't break it, but if you own it, does the state now pick up the liability to be on the hook to pay for the cleanup?
Based on the documents I reviewed, no one says that explicitly, but it sure seems that way. It sure seems that way. And I'm sure Renko is more than happy just to wipe its hands of the mess and leave somebody else to clean it up. But I don't know if they'll get roped in for part of it. I know under Superfund law and federal law, responsible parties are responsible parties, and they will get tapped to clean up Superfund sites, which this is. So we'll see. I don't know if it'll be split between the parties. Another one of those details being worked out, but I'm sure a lot of Utahns and Great Salt Lake advocates will be happy that something is finally getting done, no matter who's paying.
Do we have an estimated cost for what it'll take to clean up?
Yeah, that's a tricky number to pin down as well, but I asked EPA earlier this year for this big story I did on, what does the future hold for US magnesium? And the estimate they gave me was well over $100 million, which is insane. But in those court documents in the bankruptcy court, the state was kind of disputing that. They're like, "Well, the state haven't put forward an estimate. That's not our numbers. We haven't put a number out there." So I don't know. Maybe the state thinks with the resources it has, it won't cost as much. But there was a lot of stuff to clean up out there. There's no doubt about that.
Well, thanks for telling us about this. Very interesting story. We're talking with Leah Larson, water and land use reporter. I want to move to this one. This is interesting. Here's the headline: A rare water denial near the Great Salt Lake sparks a new lawsuit. There's kind of some complications in here, but some interesting broad implications. So I guess maybe a place to start would be Governor Cox in 2022. He closed, I'm quoting from your story, much of the Great Salt Lake Basin to new water right applications, but with, I guess, an exception or two.
Yeah, it feels like court day behind the headlines because we're talking about like new constitutional court, gerrymandering court, bankruptcy court, and now we're talking about water rights court, I guess. But yeah, back in 2022, to your point, the governor did close much of the Great Salt Lake Basin to new water rights appropriations because at that time, if you want to remember back, the Great Salt Lake was really struggling. 2022 hit it the second record low for the second year in a row. The ecosystem that was showing signs of complete collapse. We couldn't find brine flies anywhere, and the brine flies, of course, are what feed all these birds that migrate in. Brine shrimp are also struggling. So yes, the governor closed the basin, most of it, to new water rights appropriations. And then we had that great winter in 2023 where we had snowpack we'd never seen before. Which helped the lake a little bit. So a year after the governor shut down the basin to new appropriations, House Speaker Mike Schultz filed for a water right appropriation for his ranch on the Promontory Point Peninsula out there on the north arm near Spiral Jetty. So he filed an application for a bunch of water rights, and it just happened to fall within that sort of carve out that the governor had made to exclude the West Desert of Box Elder and Twilla counties. So House Speaker took advantage of that to get some water rights for his ranch. His claim was that he was going to drill these wells super, super deep so it wouldn't impact the Great Salt Lake. I think lake advocates and hydrogeologists would contend that a little bit, but he was successfully able to get those water rights. So with that in mind, another company, one of the speaker's neighbors out there on the peninsula, decided to do the same thing and had very different results.
Yeah, their application was mostly denied. Why did the is this an administrator? The state engineer, I guess, is who's ruling on this?
Yeah, the state engineer is definitely one of the top dogs when it comes to water in the state. Whenever anybody wants a water right, a new water right, or they want to change how they use their water right or sell it to somebody else, she is the person who has to sign off on everything water rights. She is the head of the Division of Water Rights as well as the state engineer. So yes, so this company called, or this landowner, I guess, called Mango Spiral Jetty LLC, which I was joking with one of my sources. Doesn't that sound like a delicious smoothie or something? Mango Spiral Jetty.
Yeah.
So they own a ranch up there that they bought in like 2018 or 2019. They filed for water rights similar to how Speaker Schultz did a couple years ago. But at the end of the year, they were denied by the state engineer and they are not happy about it. So they are suing the state.
No, part of what they wanted to do, this not the majority of the land or the water, a company called Waterleaf is involved. They want to produce lithium, right?
Right. There's so many twists and turns
Yeah,
to this spiraling
right.
story.
But I guess the lithium, usually you'd suck a lot of water. They say they can return most of the water using
Yeah. Yes.
ion filtration. But there's a catch, right? They need fresh water to rinse off their technology.
Yes, you're right. So if you think back to again, 2022 when the lake was in dire straits, all these mineral companies that currently operate on the lake, such as Compass Minerals and even US Magnesium, back when it was operational, they got all excited about lithium. Lithium was going bananas. It was in high demand to make electric vehicle batteries. So Compass Minerals, which basically pulls minerals from the lake to make fertilizer, they went all in on lithium and were like prepared to siphon even more water from the Great Salt Lake to evaporate for this lithium thing. And the state stepped in and was like, absolutely not. Like, you don't have a royalty agreement for lithium. Also, what about the lake? You can't just start pulling more water from it. So it created all this mess. Enter this company called Waterleaf and its parent company called Lilac. So they jump on the scene and they claim that they can extract lithium from the Great Salt Lake without actually depleting any of its water. So I actually went out to their pilot site over the summer over there, about a mile north of the Spiral Jetty. And I'm not a chemist or an engineer or anything, but it all looked to be working. I mean, you could see a pipe going out to the Great Salt Lake and pumping water. It ran it through this proprietary technology they have, these beads that I guess bond to the lithium while all the rest of the minerals and water pass right through. So you could see like the tanks of lithium that they had extracted, and then you could see the water going back out to the lake. So their claim is that while they're seeking a big water right to pull water from the Great Salt Lake, they promise they're not going to deplete anything. They're going to put all the water back minus the lithium. So they just finished a pilot project that wrapped in the summer, demonstrating to the state that their technology is viable. So what they're waiting for is A, their approval from the state engineer to get their water rights out of the Great Salt Lake, and B, they also, as you mentioned, need fresh water to rinse their technology and keep it operational. So they need a small bit in comparison to the briny water from the Great Salt Lake, but they do need the fresh water. When I was out there, they did tell me that they had got fresh water from some wells owned by a private landowner. Well, that private landowner happens to be Mango Spiral Jetty LLC, or at least that's how it appears. They wouldn't fully confirm that, but all signs point to this being the fact because they're leasing land owned by Mango Spiral Jetty. Mango Spiral Jetty's applying for water that it says is for lithium. And then as you dig through their debates and their protests and things, there's all these documents indicating that, like, yes, it was intended for Lilac slash Waterleaf. And that is the application that the state engineer denied, along with some of the water rights that Mango Spiral Jetty wanted for ranching. She did, however, approve two smaller water rights, I think for like 240 acre feet, which is just kind of a drip in the context of ranching. But she approved two of those water rights because she took their point in that, she had just approved Schultz's water rights. So she's like, okay, we'll let you have this water right for 240 acre feet because it happens to be right next to Schultz's ranch. So.
Finally, we just have about 2 minutes left for this, but important, I think. HB 60, sponsored by Representative Schallenberger. How would this change the process? This process includes the ability to object to proposed projects.
Yeah, I'm so
This would
glad you
change,
brought
right?
this up. Yeah, well, I mean, we don't know. Sometimes you just don't know the outcome of a bill until it becomes law, right? But this is the one that I would say water advocates, Great Salt Lake advocates, are most concerned about this session. I've heard from so many of them. Because what it does is sort of hem in what the state engineer can consider as she tries to weigh like the what we call the public welfare. She 'cause like technically the water is owned by all the people of Utah and the state of Utah. And then you apply for a right to use that water, but you don't technically own it. You just own that right that the state engineer approves because we technically all own the water. And so she's got to weigh the public welfare. And so the engineer, I believe, from what I can tell, she went to lawmakers actually and asked them to hem in the definitions so she could streamline her process and her approvals. But all these environmental groups, to your point, are super concerned because they kind of like a broad definition of public welfare that's open to interpretation, because that means they can intervene or file lawsuits and argue, like, the Great Salt Lake itself existing as a public welfare, or being able to recreate on the lake is a public welfare. They're concerned that this would mean that only people with water rights in that area, like on Promontory in this example, that would be impacted, would be the only ones allowed to protest and participate in the process. So we'll see. Like I said, it's raised a lot of concerns for people.
Well, thanks for telling us about this. The couple of stories here. We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
Yeah, anytime, anytime. Have a good weekend.
You too. Our last segment's recorded yesterday, so we'll say goodbye to Leah Larson now. Thank you so much.
See you later. Bye.
See you later. Bye now. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And coming up following a break, we'll be talking with senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Here's the headline. Is President Russell Nelson's push to drop the Mormon name working with Latter-day Saints and outsiders, and will it last? We'll talk about that following the break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Peggy, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to do it.
It was an interesting story. Here is the headline. Is President Nelson's push to drop the Mormon name working with Latter-day Saints and outsiders? Will it last? So, yeah, interesting question. You've done a deep dive into this. So remind us, I think it was 2018, early in
Yes.
his presidency, when he encouraged members of the church and I guess everybody to drop the Mormon name.
Yes, he said, he didn't just encourage, he really flat out insisted that the church members and everyone else use the full name of the church rather than the nickname Mormon, which had come to be very familiar. Everyone knew Mormon. But whenever talking about members, to use the full name of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and to call members Latter-day Saints rather than Mormon. So he said that in 2018. What he said, the reason behind this is because a lot of people do not think of Mormons as Christians, even though the name Jesus Christ is in the full name of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And he just believed that using the full name of the church more often, more commonly, would help people recognize the Christianity of the church, and it would help members also. And so that started a big campaign of his. The church had to change a bunch of websites and URLs to reflect the full name rather than used to be Mormon.org or LDS.org. He said didn't like LDS as a shortened form either, as in LDS Church. He didn't like that. Wanted the full name of the church, and then did allow Latter-day Saint instead of Mormon. And so I thought to myself, he was doing that for, almost 8 years, 7.5 years. Has it worked? Do people now think of Mormons as being Christian in ways they didn't before? And are members doing that? Are outsiders doing that? So I kind of went around interviewing a lot of different people about that.
A lot of different ways you could measure that, right? I want to jump over. You had a kind of a side story. Researcher Jenna Reese did
Yes.
a study of she got some data on searches and
Yes.
Mormon versus Latter-day Saint. What did she find?
Well, she found really mostly people are searching for the word Mormon, especially in today's world where there are secret lives of Mormon wives. Mormon has become very known sort of culturally. And so people are searching much, much more for Mormon than Latter-day Saints. Although in the last couple of years, there's been a slight uptick in searches for Latter-day Saints, but it's still dramatically below Mormon.
You talk to some, I think, church members who, some church members, there seem to be fewer of these than had the opposite point of view, but some church members especially said they appreciated the emphasis
They did.
on the
Yes,
change.
absolutely. I did talk to several people like that who said that it did remind them about the church's name and that it was inspired and that it did make them think about Jesus Christ more. One man, Luke Lyman, who is a member, actually wrote a piece about this in the Wall Street Journal. He said, I suspect Nelson wanted people to trip over the name, knowing that some would be forced to reckon with the words in the middle and the question of what it means to call yourself a follower of Jesus Christ. He concluded, no faith worth its salt is easy, and no faith worth its salt is rote. The unwieldiness of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints reminds us of that. So,
Interesting.
yes, several people said, told me, and not just a writer like that, but several members told me it did remind them that Jesus Christ is at the center of the church.
Now you found an opposite point of view among several people. What were they saying? They still wanted to use Mormon?
Well, starting off with journalists and scholars, people like that, just said, first of all, the full name of the church is a mouthful. It's hard to get it. You certainly can't get it in a headline, and it's very hard to use it when writing about the church. The other problem is that very few people have really actually heard of Latter-day Saints, and whereas they have heard of Mormon, and so it's complicated. And beyond that, several people said that, first of all, Latter-day Saints isn't any more about Jesus than Mormon. And third of all, you've got people who say, well, we believe our scripture is called the Book of Mormon. That's where the Mormon term came in the first place. And Mormon history, all of that kind of strips people from their past and their connectedness and their, it's more known, it's more familiar, it feels more natural to lots of people. So yeah, both members and media and scholars, lots of people said they wished to just continue to use Mormon.
Now, especially for scholars, I've heard scholars talk about this, that Mormon is broader than, Latter-day Saint, that Mormon
It
encompasses culture and some of the history.
exactly. I mean, listen, obviously the Salt Lake Tribune has as a podcast called Mormon Land. And what we mean by that is all the people who connect to the term Mormon might not be currently active members, but they're still fall under that umbrella. And yes, so it just when you're talking about outsiders like historians writing to a general audience, the term Mormon is much more identifiable. Most of the people I talked to, media, scholars, historians, whatever, did not mean to be disrespectful to the prophet or to the church, but they just had to use Mormon for clarity, for people to understand what group it is they're talking about. Otherwise, even the full name of the church, the average American is not familiar with that. So let's say you're a pollster and you're calling up cold calling someone, and you say, "What do you think of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?" Nine times out of 10, they won't know who that is. And then if the pollster says, you know, Mormons, they're like, oh, yes, I do have an opinion about that.
Does the church itself have anything to say about this?
Yes, the church said, gave me a statement that they have done some polling as well, and they show those that data show quote consistent use of the correct name of the church has strengthened perceptions of the church as Christian and increased overall awareness of the church worldwide. And these insights, the spokesperson said, continue to guide efforts to more clearly represent the central role of Jesus Christ in the church's identity. So, yes, the church itself, according to that statement, thinks it's been an, on balance overall a good effort.
No, for President Nelson, it was decidedly not a branding effort. He regarded this as a revelation, and
Yes.
but some of the people you talked to kind of put it in that context, or rebranding.
Yes, I did talk to some branding experts, and just asked them, well, what do you think? Has this changed people's mind? Has this is it catching on, this sort of new brand? And I did have one expert tell me that just from a business point of view, he's not speaking about anything spiritual. He just says, he compares it to the Utah Jazz playing at the Delta Center, and then it got changed to Energy Solutions Arena and then Vivint. But for most of the time, fans still called it the Delta Center. And he's just said the bar was too high for the Delta Center to change its name. It sure seems too high for the church, he said. Rather than change the name, he says, why not alter the perception of the name? And that actually was exactly what a previous president, Gordon Hinckley, was trying to do. He was behind the previous I'm a Mormon campaign. He knew that people had some negative feelings about Mormonism. And so the church created this whole I Am a Mormon initiative, which happened during Mitt Romney's run for the US presidency. And he said, instead of changing our name from Mormon to Latter-day Saint or to something else, let's try to make people's perception of Mormon better. And so there was this whole campaign where people taped themselves saying, I'm a skateboarder, I'm a book lover, I'm a gardener, and I am a Mormon, to try to infuse that word with positivity. And it really worked. At that time, there was a more positive view of Mormons than had been true in the past. So this is a new directive.
I found this especially interesting. You got the view from abroad. In fact, that's the subheadline. You talked to a Belgian Latter-day Saint. What did he say?
Well, he was very disheartened by this move because he has spent literally decades convincing Europeans that Mormonism is not a cult. And he loved that I'm a Mormon campaign and the Mormon Helping Hands, you know, where members are helping other people and they wear yellow shirts that say Mormons Helping Hands. And it was a way of normalizing the word Mormon or the church. And then he said, to not be able to use all that effort now is lost. And now he says international media only use it when it com you know use it when it comes to things like secret lives of Mormon wives, and it's kind of back to, oh, the church is a cult. And the other thing that he said, which is so interesting, is that one unintended consequence of constantly repeating the church's full name is the many might not focus on the Jesus Christ part in the middle, but the end part, the Latter-day Saint mentioned. Mormon is a proper name. It's a name of a character in the Book of Mormon. And that word is the same in every language. But Latter-day Saints can be translated differently in different languages. In Chinese, it is Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints Church, or literally Jesus Christ later period Holy Saints Church, Holy Ones of the Last Days. And that also doesn't say Jesus Christ. It a little bit sounds like end times, apocalyptic. And is that how the church wants to be known?
You talk to a Latter-day Saint podcaster. This is kind of interesting. Gets into the culture, I guess. I'll just quote this. She says, "At the time, I worried this push from President Nelson would become yet another shibboleth, a sorting mechanism used by some members to determine others' faithfulness." I don't know if she felt that it had gone down that way.
You know what? That is what I heard the most often, which is that it has been used as a kind of weapon against members or media that continue to use the term Mormon as if it's some evil thing or bad thing, or as she puts it, a shibboleth. It's like it's become a bit of a tool for judging, which is really unfortunate that anybody who loves the church is continues to be involved in it, but uses the term Mormon, then this gives people a sense, oh, they're not following the prophet, and so judges them.
Somebody that was searching for it in the story, but there's somebody who said, "Well, we need more time, right? The
Yes.
next generation might not be so wedded to Mormon. This might work in the next generation."
It's true. I mean, there could be. If the younger generation of today is growing up without the word Mormon, maybe in a couple more generations when the oldsters have died off or something. Unfortunately, as the person at the end of my story says, right now there is no easy substitute for Mormon. Latter-day Saints doesn't work, as we've said, in lots of places. The full name of the church just doesn't work because it's too long. It doesn't fit in any sentences. It doesn't fit in a headline. And Mormon has just been very, very good at that for those reasons. But in the future, maybe the church will evolve away from it. And maybe they just have to take their time and wait it out. I don't know.
So for the immediate future, we have a new church president, right? President Oakes. Uh, any
Yes.
any idea how he feels about this, or if he's going to continue this push?
Well, actually, that was yet another reason why I took on this project was b both because I was wanted to see how it was faring, but I also wondered if Dallin Oaks would continue this or whether he would back away from it or do something else. Most people I talked to did not think that he would come out against President Nelson's edict, but maybe it will soften it or not push it so much. And one person told me he's heard plenty of anecdotes that where Oakes still uses the M word himself. So, some people thought he would do something dramatic, and other people said, no, he doesn't think he would do that. So, again, I don't think we know about President Oakes and what his view of it is. It certainly doesn't seem to have been as big a concern for him as it was for President Nelson.
Well, we shall see, and I'm sure you'll be covering this. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Peggy, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure, Tom.
And you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.